You took your friends your secret when you left your office last night. You closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all. This little birdie told me who was talking to a fly on the wall. So when you think nobody's looking on the eye that passes by you, when you think nobody's listening, I'm the listener. I'm the resistor.
This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger. Central Indiana, transmitting to the world.
Saturn's Day here in the bunker, and I don't really need to put out a show today, but I just decided I will put out a show. I can put out a show if I goddamn want to, okay? Oh, there's a lot of funny things going on. That's why I'm just happier than a pig in slop. What is this? Thousands of people canceled their ESPN subscriptions because of these Negroes kneeling down at the American flag. Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn, but it's funny because they won't get excited at all about the basketball and so forth being taken over by Niggers. Nothing about that. Even races, even Klansmen go to all these football games. I know they do. I know they do because I saw him do it when I was running the Klan. What kind of racist are you? You're no racist. You love that nigger ball. So it's funny as hell. It's funny as hell. But even though it's getting done one way or another, sometimes the path to the palace is through the dungeons, as Rockwell used to say. You never know. Sometimes to get something done, you got to do it a different way. You know, I was downtown this morning buying some meat from the farmer's market, which they block off a street here in town, right in front of the courthouse. I looked over there on the courthouse lawn, and they had all these signs, the pro-Hillary signs. And they had some people out there with a card table, and they had this mixed-race flag with all these different colors draped right up the steps of the courthouse. So I sauntered over. They didn't know who I was. Started talking to them. I said, you know, only 30% of the people think that Hillary's telling the truth. What do you think about that? Oh, well, that's that propaganda. That's that Republican stuff. They said, how you vote? You going to vote for Hillary? I said, no. You going to vote for Trump? I said, no. I'm voting for none of the above. And I didn't get much disagreement either from these people. They're not really excited about Hillary. I'm going to have a rally there this afternoon. I was thinking of going back down there and talking to these people. I said, I sort of lean towards Hillary because she's going to bring this whole thing down. That's what we need to do. You know you're not going to change it by your voting. And I didn't get much disagreement from these so-called left-wingers. Quite interesting. How about this deal with the basketball? Did I say that already? Where thousands of people are canceling their ESPN accounts because of the Negro thing? Yeah, I said that before, didn't I? Yeah. Well, I've said all along these hate crime laws are going to come back and bite them in the ass. And now that we've got a third world country with millions more non-whites, it's going to bite them in the ass. Because now there's a lot of people of color complaining they're being hate crimed. And guess who by? Other non-whites. This is an article from the San Diego Union. Actually, it's a black gal that's put it up here. It's not a new argument. Hate crime allegations, which increase punishments by underlying crimes like assault, are both unfair and unnecessary. You see, they're starting to back out of this hate crime thing because it's starting to come over on their side of the fence. That's how some people view them anyway. Deputy District Attorney Oscar Garcia, who has specialized in hate crime prosecutions in San Diego County for more than a decade, said he's heard it all before, including from judges and lawyers, and he has an interesting counterpoint. Quote, a lot of times these crimes have ramifications beyond the immediate victim, unquote, Garcia said. State and federal lawmakers, he said, have long supported the idea of harsher penalties for behavior that causes greater damage to society. Wonder where she's going with this. The prosecutors explained that when a person is targeted because of their race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, or disability, it tends to increase the emotional trauma that an individual victim experiences and sends ripples of fear and anger throughout the community. People ask themselves, what could be done in the future to make ourselves safer, Garcia said. Often the answer is nothing. You cannot change the thing that makes you more of a target, and you should not be expected to change, he said. But they're beating on my ass, man. So local prosecutors file hate crime allegations in cases where they believe they have evidence to prove the crime was motivated in part by bias. That can be challenging. A third of the suspects in these cases have legitimate mental health issues, Garcia said. They're nuts. And victims can... That's because Ronald Reagan opened up the doors of the mental institutions and pushed them all out on the street way back when he was president. And victims can be reluctant to report the crimes for fear of retaliation. Well, that's possible. And then there's the argument that these kinds of allegations punish free speech. Well, that's for sure. Just because an assailant used an epithet during an attack doesn't mean it's a hate crime. Usually there is more to it than that. See, things are changing. A judge order in a case now pending in Vista, which was about 15 miles from where I used to live in Fallbrook, seems to underscore that point. Superior Court Judge Harry Elias this month ordered three suspected Fallbrook gang members to stand trial in the fatal stabbing of a 33-year-old black man. Hugh Pettigrew III, who prosecutors said was attacked at random while walking in a small North County town. Deputy District Attorney Christine Bannon argued that the killing was racially motivated because the defendants are members of a gang that purportedly hates black people. The judge rejected the argument, saying there was no specific evidence that the two of the three defendants, Kevin Garcia, 21, and Tyler Ryan, 25, attacked the victim because of his race. Hate crimes allegations for those two defendants were dismissed. See what's happening here? Slowly but surely, they're getting stuck on their own petard. The judge said, in fact, one of those two guys was non-white. The judge said evidence presented during the two-day preliminary hearing showed one of the defendants may have been motivated by bias. Ryan Valdez moniker was listed with other alleged gang members on some anti-black graffiti found in Fallbrook. So it's the Mexicans versus the Negroes. But his defense lawyer argued that Valdez, 18, neither wrote the graffiti nor added his name to it. The prosecutor later dropped the hate crime allegation against Valdez. A conviction of first-degree murder in California carries a sentence of 25 years to life in prison. A hate crime allegation of enhancement, if found to be true, can tack on up to 4 more years after you've done 25. According to the State Attorney General's Office, the number of hate crime events in California went up 10.4% in 2015 to 837 from 758 the previous year. Overall, hate crime events in the state decreased by nearly 36% over the past decade, I think because many of those crimes were committed by non-white against non-white. Hate crimes with a race, ethnicity, or national origin bias were consistently the most common type. Within that category, hate crimes with an anti-black bias motivation were the most common at just under 32%. And as you get more Mexicans in California, I'm sure there are going to be more mestizo on black hate crimes. Hate crimes with a sexual orientation bias were the second most common, and religious bias was third, with the majority targeting Jews. Called him a Jaime. Call me a kike. Kill him. Last year in San Diego County, 22 hate crime cases were referred to the district attorney's office. Of those, 14 resulted in hate crime convictions, and 8 ended in convictions for non-hate crime offenses. The San Diego City Attorney's Office, which handles misdemeanor cases in the city, reported 3 hate crime cases in 2015. All of them resulting in convictions, but only one for a hate crime offense. You see how mixed up and screwed up this is going to get? I think it's beautiful. More and more of these so-called hate crimes are going to come out of the violence between the other races, the non-white races, and less against whites. And that's going to be interesting. It's happening all the time now. And the blacks are going to say, wait a minute, we didn't mean yet, Mr. Jaime Chu. What are you doing to us? We just wanted to get white guys. Now you're turning it around, man. That ain't fair. That is not fair. Oh boy, here's the end of the world. A Jewish female reporter for the political news website Politico has been targeted with anti-Jew messages from Donald Trump supporter. Yeah, they tried to make it look like it was Donald Trump. Well, Hades Gold is the editor of Politico's On the Media blog. A photoshopped image of Gold was posted Monday on the Twitter, including a bloody bullet hole in her forehead and a yellow star worn by Jews in Nazi Germany pinned to her chest. She also received emails with threatening and anti-Semitic messages. How do they know she was a Trump supporter? Unless she told them. That's weird. I love free speech. Do it every day. Well, here's the message. Don't mess with our boy Trump or you'll be the first in line for the camp, unquote. Read a message accompanied by the photo. Aliyah or line up by the wall, your choice. Aliyah is a Hebrew term for immigrating to Israel. Well, since most right-wing conservative yahoos don't know what that means, I doubt whether it came from racist. The Twitter account that sent the message has been suspended, according to BuzzFeed, which published a screenshot of the image. Politico notified Twitter of the threatening and vile tweets, and Twitter acted promptly to suspend the account. There were many more tweets and emails, some even more vile, if that is imaginable. A police report is in the process of being filed, said Politico in a statement. And as for saying nasty things about a Jewess, how about that? Don't you dare offend those Jewesses. Well, since this is the Saturday Digest, let's see what Max Kaiser's got to say.
Hi, I'm Max Kaiser. This is the Kaiser Report. You know, bankers, policymakers, guys who run our lives on a day-to-day basis have a total disconnect between their actions and what happens to real people. Like Eric Holder, for example, totally scammed us with his participation in the HSBC cover-up. And he doesn't think that because he disregards the rule of law that there might be consequences, like 60,000 dead Mexicans decapitated by drug lords. That's the subject we're going to be talking about right now with an interview with Eric that we pigeonholed at the airport. Stacey.
Right. We actually did, we were on a flight. Eric Holder was sitting behind us. We're going to show the interview we did with him, but first I want to set it up with a headline from the summer explaining Eric Holder. It's important to understand Eric Holder was the Attorney General of the United States of America. Just a week or two ago, we revealed via the WikiLeaks Podesta emails that he was hand-chosen by Citigroup. He was one of the 31 names for Obama's cabinet, hand-chosen by Citigroup to be Barack Obama's cabinet. But I want to look at a headline from this summer setting up this HSBC story, because you do confront him about this. While we were at Reagan Washington International Airport, or National Airport. And this is from the summer, and it was based on a congressional inquiry. A House Financial Services Committee looked into what happened with HSBC. Eric Holder's longtime excuse for not prosecuting banks just crashed and burned. So a new thoroughly documented report from the House Financial Services Committee supports the theory that basically Holder was lying, okay, about the fact that Eric Holder had said he tried his hardest. If there had been evidence, he would have gone hard after these bankers. Well, the report recounts how career prosecutors in 2012 wanted to criminally charge the global bank HSBC for facilitating money laundering for Mexican drug lords and terrorist groups. But Holder said no. So he said no. Eric Holder said no. He overruled his own lawyers at the Department of Justice who presented to HSBC criminal charges and a huge fine. Eric Holder backed down. We'll go into the details, but...
Right. Well, you know, to get the Attorney General to step in and halt investigation and to halt a prosecution into a big bank like HSBC is a whole nother level of corruption. Usually, when banks commit fraud, when banks commit malfeasance, when banks commit insider trading and market manipulation, and when they rip off customers, it goes to a panel of arbiters that weigh in on favor of the banks, because when people sign a new bank account form, they relinquish their right to a jury trial, and they must go to arbitration, and the arbitration panel is stacked with bankers, and very rarely does a customer ever win against a bank or a broker. In this case, HSBC, the crimes are so egregious. There were so many dead Mexicans in the desert, decapitated, like with their heads on turtles, like in Breaking Bad. And there was so much money going border to border to border, and there was such overwhelming evidence against HSBC that you had to get the Attorney General, one of the most corrupt guys ever, to sit in that office to step in and say, no, no, let's not go after the big bank. It's too big to fail. It's systemically too important. And, by the way, my law firm's going to hire me when I get out of this job, and I make the big bucks because I'm corrupt. I'm Eric Holder. I'm a schmuck.
So, in particular, it was in September 2012 when the Justice Department's Asset Forfeiture and Money Laundering Section, AFMLS, formally recommended that HSBC be prosecuted for its numerous financial crimes. So Eric Holder himself then received a phone call from George Osborne saying that this would be a big issue and he can't do this and blah, blah, blah. We don't know what happened, but Eric Holder then overruled his own Department of Justice. The report documents how Holder and his top associates were concerned about the impact that prosecuting HSBC would have on the global economy, and in particular, they worried that a guilty plea would trigger a hearing over whether to revoke HSBC's charter to do banking in the United States. Now, of course, we are in voting season. How many blacks have been disenfranchised because of any relationship at all to the drugs business in America, little bits of marijuana or whatever, and they have they are deprived of their right to ever vote again through these felony charges? Here is a guy who didn't want to disenfranchise HSBC. He was afraid of disenfranchising them, and yet millions and millions of Americans every year are disenfranchised through his own war on drugs. Their assets are forfeited, their assets are seized. We confronted him about that as well at the airport.
The ironic thing is, it's Ronald Reagan Airport. Remember, it was a war on drugs. Nancy Reagan was, just so you know. And here's freaking Eric Holder, a pseudo-black man in Ronald Reagan Airport. He disenfranchised millions of blacks. He didn't want to step on the toe of the big white brother in the UK, HSBC. You know, Whitey needs to be appeased. Well, the four big banks in the UK, that's the head of the snake. We've been saying that all along from the beginning.
I have the snake here. This is why I wore this shirt. But I have to get into the details of this before we go to the clip at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C., where we confronted Eric Holder. The documents also show that on November 7th, Holder presented HSBC with a take-it-or-leave-it offer, a deferred prosecution agreement, which involved a cash settlement and future monitoring of HSBC. No guilty plea was required. It also, in addition, HSBC successfully negotiated to have individual executives immunized from prosecution over transactions with foreign terrorist organizations and other sanctioned entities. He provided immunization. They will never be prosecuted for their
immunization from involvement with terrorism.
Yes.
That's financial terrorism. Holder aided and abetted financial terrorism,
yes.
i.e. terrorism, i.e. he's a terrorist.
So Holder is also famous for a 1999 Department of Justice memo.
I was very nervous when he got on the plane with me.
Okay.
I was going to talk to the stewardess and say, stewardess, there's a financial terrorist on this airplane. His name is Eric Holder. But I thought, I'll let it go this time. But I got very, very nervous. I didn't know what was in that briefcase.
Okay.
It could have been anything in that briefcase.
And also, as a Department of Justice functionary in 1999, Holder is infamous for writing in a collateral consequences memo. He advised prosecutors to take into account economic damage that might result from criminally convicting a major corporation. So this is in his modus operandi. I also want to set up this throw to the video at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C. I did confront him about the fine, which he considers as asset forfeiture to HSBC. The fine, it sounds like $9 billion. It's $1.9 billion.
Yeah, that's the amount of money his drug dealer friends carry around in their sock.
Well, I also want to note that everybody, of course, in the video will say, why didn't you ask about Fast and Furious? But we're fast and furiously going to throw to the clip at Reagan National Airport in Washington, D.C.
Hey, Erica.
Hey.
How you doing?
Pretty good.
Mr. Holder, can we ask you a few questions?
Who are you?
You're with RT. Kaiser Report Market Finance Scandal.
Do what?
We're Kaiser Report. We do a show about market finance and scandal.
All right.
First of all, I want to ask you about the Michael Froman emails to Podesta, which show that Citigroup had selected a Barack Obama's cabinet, including yourself. So what do you have to say to those Podesta emails?
That's just silly.
Yeah.
The decisions about my position in the cabinet had absolutely nothing to do with those things. And history will show that the process was a lot more benign than is indicated in that. Emails can be interpreted in a whole bunch of ways. They can be thoughts that people have who are not ultimately, intimately involved in the process.
Yeah.
I know I was picked. It had nothing to do with my firm.
Yeah, okay. And what about the fact that Carl Levin's report from the Senate found that Goldman Sachs had sold what they called Sachs. Sorry for the vulgar language, but that was their language. They sold Sachs to pension funds around the United States, calling them collateralized debt obligations.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that? Carl Levin's report from the Senate?
Ma'am, I was Attorney General for 6 years.
Yeah.
There's a whole variety of things that, you know, I dealt with. I've now been removed from that position for almost two idle.
You resigned. Yeah. Okay.
All right.
And had you been able to sleep better at night and, you know, put some of these bankers in jail, do you think Wells Fargo would have felt comfortable selling 2 million fraudulent accounts to their own clients, opening up fraudulent bank accounts?
Well, see, I think that's one of the great misinterpretations of what it is we did at the Justice Department. We were pretty effective, I think, in bringing individuals to holding individuals account, certainly getting record-setting historic fines, and I think, you know, it's a nice myth that people have propagated about what it is that we did with regard to individuals. And before I left, I set up the task force that ultimately produced the Gates memo.
So when George Osborne reached out from the UK and asked to go soft on HSBC when they were caught laundering money for Mexican drug cartels, was that something yet you now regret, having resulted in massive scandals in Mexico, 60,000 dead in Mexico?
Oh, come on, man. You can't possibly think that what we did in connection with the resolution of a financial
a straight up and down case of money laundering for HSBC. You guys, George Osborne reached out to you guys, said go soft on the case.
The connection that you're drawing between that which was a financial determination and the deaths of people in Mexico is inconsistent with the facts.
Yeah.
You know, you're starting to sensationalize something that really has no bearing, no connection to that which is factually accurate. And there's a responsibility that you have to examine the facts, not sensationalize things,
but to do some research. But many Americans have their assets seized based on even remote connections to any drug dealing or money laundering. But HSBC saw no assets seized, no executives put in jail. Neither did Wachovia, by the way.
HSBC had no assets seized?
Well, they paid a fine. They paid a $9 million fine.
And that's a little inconsistent with what you just said, isn't it?
No, but they get their personal assets seized. Mr. Holder, can I have a deferred prosecution agreement before you go away?
Well, there you have it. Of course, he famously made a remark that the banks were too big to prosecute. That's the legacy of Eric Holder. And the HSBC case is where that whole too big to jail phenomenon started. And not to admit that there is a direct connection between money laundering, drug cartel activity, and the deaths in Mexico is downright foolish.
The Kaiser Report, I'm Max Kaiser. Time now to turn to Francine McKenna.
Transparency reporter at Market Watch. Francine, welcome back.
Great to see you back in D.C.
All righty. Speaking about D.C., on our way here on the plane, we ran into Eric Holder. What will history show and say about his reign at the Department of Justice?
Well, he's going to have to wait a long time to let history rest on his reign. Him and Robert Kuzami, the former SEC enforcement director during the same time, are going to have to wait for a long time because in this era of email leaks and other kinds of news coming out all the time about the past, they can never really rest.
Right, but it sounds like the verdict on his reign is coming in immediately. In other words, he's been shown now to be complicit in a massive cover-up and criminality.
That's what it seems to point to, but I think it's going to depend on how all of that is interpreted. It's really hard when you're looking at those emails to make sense of it without full context. But certainly the criticism was already there that they were complicit with the banks in all of the things that were done during the crisis.
He denies that Citigroup chose him as Attorney General. Who will be denying similar in Hillary's administration? Which corporation or bank is choosing for her? Will it be the same Summers Rubin camp? You know, the Podesta WikiLeaks email show that Citibank executives essentially picked the cabinet for Obama. And including Eric Holder, he denies that was the case. Who's the big player now heading into the next administration in this regard?
The most back and forth seems to be about Gary Gensler, the former CFTC head. And as you know, or you might know, many of your readers are aware, he's still subject to an investigation by the CFTC for the MF Global failure. He was on... his administration of the CFTC during that time says Corzine is still, the jury's still not out. And I think that that leaves a mixed legacy for somebody like Gary Gensler that a lot of people seem to like and seem to want, but in my opinion still has a mixed record too close to industry.
Were you surprised by the revelation that essentially Wall Street picked the cabinet for Obama?
Oh, not at all. And as many of the emails show, they do that early on. I mean, people have been talking about who could or who would be in a cabinet. I've written several stories about potential nominees and whether Elizabeth Warren would have that much influence over those picks or should, and which departments she could or would want to. The SEC seems to be something that's carved out for Elizabeth Warren, and that may be good for those who are looking for reform, but the rest of it seems to be status quo.
Now, talking about Eric Holder, follow-up, of course, he claims he had sleepless nights, worried he'd be forced to apply the law to bankers, essentially. What about Deutsche Bank? We know the Department of Justice capitulated on HSBC's drug money laundering. Have they backed down on this too-big-to-fail German bank? In other words, Deutsche Bank's in the crosshairs. They've already walking away from applying some penalties. Are they just going to let this one slide as well?
Yeah, because it would be really too bad if the Deutsche Bank bankers had to get Deutsche stock for their bonuses instead of actual cash. So we're seeing a replay of what happened during the crisis where, you know, everybody knows that this stuff is iffy and they don't want that bank stock. They want cash in hand, and I would too if I worked for most of them. But that's the situation. They're more worried about embarrassing the bankers, embarrassing these executives, or making them actually have a less than super rich retirement than they are about homeowners and consumers and shareholders, the retail shareholder.
Now, my understanding is that the inspector general covering the TARP funds. Remember, everyone remembers TARP. Hank Paulson, you know, in the famous $750 billion blank check that was handed to Wall Street. That's still going on, right? And what's the latest?
It's still going on. And a new report out by the current inspector general says that she's very worried about the ongoing oversight of, for example, the HAMP program. That was the program that gave mortgage modifications. And the reason is because all of the banks that have been getting this money as mortgage servicers are all repeat offenders, recidivists in terms of all kinds of illegal acts. And they have to really, really look at them closely and monitor them closely to make sure that at least half of the billions of dollars that they've already given them, when they continue giving that over the next 7 years, that they actually use it wisely. That agency is just working full-time to try to make sure that that money is not wasted.
And they're trying to pass a law that would
make it the CEO's responsibility to have some kind of oversight in case of criminal activity?
Yeah, in the same way that the Sarbanes-Oxley causes CEOs and CFOs to certify that controls are in place before the reports come out, she would like to see CEOs of the banks in particular, that's who she's responsible for, actually have to do their due diligence personally. She emphasized to me personally that they personally oversaw looking at every thing up and down and could no longer be insulated, no longer could claim plausible deniability of what happened down in the Minion range, and actually sign off that there was no crime or fraud or illegal acts going on in any part of their institution. I think it's a really big ticket. She hopes the Congress picks that up in the next session.
Well, we know from John Stumpf over there at Wells Fargo that he oversaw a criminal racketeering organization, millions of accounts opened fraudulently, banks stole money from customers. He claims that there was an arm's-length relationship, he knew nothing about it, and so this is exactly how the Gambino family or some other crime family is organized. The Capo, the godfather, is insulated from the whackers and the leg breakers and the murderers in his organization. Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger over there, Berkshire Hathaway, largest shareholders, say nothing. Their silence is remarkable, really. Charlie Munger is still flapping his lips, talking about how great he is. Everyone should suck it up. And yet he's not commenting on the fact that one of his largest shareholdings is committing massive serial fraud at the expense of the American people.
Exactly. It's a see nothing, hear nothing, please don't tell me anything about it kind of an approach. And I think that, this Inspector General of the TARP Fund is saying it's just not acceptable anymore for any of these executives to be hiding, covering up fraud at the lower levels and claiming that they're not responsible. It's the classic problem of the too big to fail, in that they're too big to manage, they're too big to monitor, they're too big for these guys who are supposedly accountable for the whole organization to actually know what's going on, or at least to be able to plausibly admit that they could possibly know what's going on.
Let's turn back to the 2016 election. Thanks to you and the Kaiser Report, the only global news program to get the Trump tax story right. Well, last time you were here, we were talking about his reluctance to release his tax forms. You were saying he probably doesn't pay any tax due to the nature of his real estate holdings and the tax laws carry forwards that come with that business. He probably doesn't pay any taxes. You're absolutely correct. Any follow-up to that?
The follow-up is that many people developed all kinds of wild, crazy theories about why he might be having these significant losses that were reported for 1995, the one very minimal amount of information that any news organization had. And my theory, going all the way back to March, was that it was depreciation, again, based on his real estate holdings. And in the second debate, he said that. He said, I love losses, I love depreciation, and that's really what it's all about. So if you believe him, and many people don't, because he doesn't have a very good track record of always telling the truth, but if you believe what he says, that's what it's all about, and it's nothing probably more complicated than that.
Right, but the average punter out there would have difficulty kind of assimilating all that information. Now, we talk about the Obamacare and so-called Affordable Care Act, and it's just been announced that the premiums are going to be up 25%. Your thoughts?
Well, it's a difficult situation, and I think that there's a lot of controversy on either side. But personally, I'm a single-payer advocate, and I look and say, it's an insurance program, so what did they expect? They left all of the management in the hands of insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies and other medical care and medical device providers, and they have a classic, chronic reputation for fraud and cheats. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are constantly being criminally prosecuted for Foreign Corrupt Practice Act, for other kinds of price gouging. So what did they expect? Under the guise of an insurance program, they're allowed to continue this this graft and this fraud.
Yeah, and thanks to the cheap money from the Federal Reserve and the global banking system, you have more consolidation, mergers and acquisitions in that industry. So pretty soon we're going to be talking about one insurance company, one drug company, who are going to rule over this market, like in some kind of Soviet paradise.
I think every other day we've got a pharmaceutical company wanting to merge with another pharmaceutical company, and insurance companies, yes, there's been consolidation. And I think the biggest issue on the Obamacare is that they left it to for-profit insurance companies to run it, and so they shouldn't be surprised that if it becomes unprofitable to them and the government isn't prepared to subsidize their losses when you offer insurance coverage to a broader group of people who didn't have it before, that they're going to opt out of the process. And so the fact that they even had a choice to opt out of the process means we end up with potentially less than what we had before.
Right. Well, turning it into a market and handing it over to market manipulators seemed like a non-starter. Now, any meager bit of policy plans from either candidate to look forward to?
Well, there's a little bit of a talk about Hillary Clinton's tax plan. And there was talk today about the fact that she may allow the companies who've been stashing cash overseas to bring that back at a lower tax rate if we can sort of take that money and put it towards infrastructure. Again, lots of promises are always made in these elections. The mechanics of them are always left to somebody else to manage. And we end up with corporations being able to bring that cash back at a lower tax rate, something that they've done before, that they have allowed before, and that hasn't worked to change their behavior. As soon as the rate goes up or as soon as that program is over, they start stashing the cash.
Right. Tim Cook,
again,
the CEO of Apple Computer, his comment was he didn't think his tax rate was fair.
Well, he says, I'll bring it back when the tax rate is low, as if they have a choice. And basically, they think they have a choice. They can leave it over there indefinitely, and nobody and nothing is going to force them to have to pay a lower tax rate.
Well, in revelations that AT&T has been spying on folks for many years now, and you've got privatization of the surveillance state, and you've got complicity between corporations and government, now we've gotten to the stage of American history where we are subjected to threats. Either you allow Tim Cook to interpret the tax code for his benefit, or we'll threaten you. And isn't that the same as a vicious dictatorship?
Well, it's certainly not something to look forward to. You're right. You have the media companies mixing with the cellular companies like Verizon with AOL and now Time Warner with AT&T. And it's not something that I think is going to be easy to manage. There's a lot of people in Washington who are worried about the antitrust and the non-competitive aspects of those mergers that are coming up.
Is it too much to say we're heading into a police state?
I would say it's too much to say that, but I would say that we have to be constantly vigilant and constantly monitoring these situations and fight back when it seems to be out of control.
So you're an optimist.
I try to be.
All right, Francie McKenna, thanks for being on the Kaiser Report.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this edition of the Kaiser Report with me, Max Kaiser, and Stacey Herbert. I'd like to thank our...
Now let's see what Rush T, RT TV, coming out of Russia's thinking about our election.
Play well in the U.S. elections. Also, what is the role of journalism today? And RT is again in the news. Fox Stories in the Media. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, James Bradley. He's a New York Times number one best-selling author. His latest book is The China Mirage. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. And in London, we cross to Adam Gari. He is a writer for TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much encourage it. I'd like to go to Adam first in London. Living here in Moscow, you living in London, who would have thought that Vladimir Putin would be front and center in this presidential election year? During the last debate, Hillary Clinton was challenged about open borders in the Western Hemisphere, and her reaction was, Donald Trump is going to be, if elected, a puppet of Vladimir Putin. That's very difficult to connect those two dots, but even more bizarre is how Vladimir Putin and Russia found itself front and center in this election.
That's quite surprising, and it's equally silly. Hillary Clinton, of course, has met Vladimir Putin many times. Donald Trump hasn't met him ever. He's expressed that he wants to, which is obviously going to be a priority when he becomes the president. Now, turning to the debate itself, when she went on one of her quite hysterical and nonsensical anti-Putin rants in the middle of a question about Mexican immigration, what that has to do with Russia, no man can say. Her ratings, in terms of her approval, fell dramatically during that portion There's a focus group that does a little monitor of people's approval of the candidate's statements, and much like a hot monitor for a dying patient, not that she would know what that might look like, her ratings plunged both amongst her supporters and undecided, and of course Trump supporters, so it doesn't play well. Most Americans don't know a great deal about Putin, many more don't care, and quite a few more of them are beginning to say, well, he looks competent and our leaders don't, he looks strong, and to quote Mr. Lavrov, our leaders are rather pussified, and he actually stands up against terrorism, which most Americans are frightened of. They're not exactly frightened against President Assad in Damascus, miles away. The weirdest thing, though, of all, is that they did agree on one thing. For the first time in American presidential history, both of the major candidates agree the election is rigged. The only thing they disagree on is who is rigging it and against whom.
Okay, and we'll get there on election day. You know, Dima, one of the interesting things is from a campaign point of view, you actually kind of have to tip your hat to Hillary Clinton and her team, because they've been able to switch and bait this entire election since the summer. I have looked at these emails that have been released by WikiLeaks. There are so many to read. You could write doctoral dissertations on this stuff. There is so much there. And their reply is the source. And the source for them is not WikiLeaks. It is Russia. And you know what? And what bothers me the most, it doesn't surprise me the American people might believe that. What I find disturbing is that mainstream media accepts that explanation, because I do not really want to talk about those emails.
Well, I mean, it started even before. I'm actually surprised that Hillary Clinton discussing Mexican immigration did not mention that Putin could be driving these migrants into the United States, because the head of the NATO forces in Europe just about 3 or 4 months ago, he accused Russia, Putin and Assad of actually driving
weaponizing
migration. Yeah. Exactly, driving migrants from the Middle East to Europe. So I'm not surprised. I mean, when you have the covers like this, you know, Russia wants to undermine faith in U.S. election, don't fall for it. I mean, this is pure propaganda. When you have an assertion which is not corroborated by any facts, and you have a call for action or inaction, you know, don't believe anything Trump says, he is Putin's puppet, and they all repeat it all the time, you know. Clinton's running mate wrote on his Twitter account that we don't need a Russian puppet in the White House. I mean, this is nonsense, but people, when they hear nonsense every day, ultimately should start questioning it. And this is my hope.
You know, it's a very interesting point here, because I have asked repeatedly on this program, does it really have an impact? Do voters accept this? And I find it's very hard that they do, or really if they care very much about it. But journalists are aware of this here. We had Chris Cuomo at CNN, you know, saying that viewers shouldn't read it because it's stolen property. But Chris Cuomo and CNN will explain everything you need to know about these emails. This is, again, mainstream media working with the sitting government in the United States, actively helping the candidacy of Clinton here. And this is something I have never seen before, at least at this scale.
I think that it's a very effective argument that she's making. It's ridiculous. It's not.
Why? Because most people don't really know much about Russia, or the only thing they know is what they get from the mass media.
I know what they know. I was on a panel with newspaper editors last week, in 2 weeks ago, in Minnesota, and it sold. Putin is aggressive. He invades countries. There'd be peace in Syria if it wasn't for Putin. I mean, Joe McCarthy was looking for, no one knew who Joe McCarthy was, and he was looking for an issue that would resonate with the American public, and he came up with who lost China, and the Russians are in the basement. You know, the Russians are coming. That was a very effective thing for Joe McCarthy. He wrote it for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton was told by a journalist I never heard of, Brent Budowski, who wrote to John Podesta and said, wow, ISIS you're vulnerable on, but so switch it over to Putin. Connect Trump with Putin. This is a Democratic strategy. This is the new McCarthyism. And I just want to say that in the debate, Hillary just didn't pivot to Putin. She said to Chris Wallace, I actually think, Chris, that the most important question of this evening, The most important question in this debate is if Donald Trump will admit and condemn that the Russians are doing this and make it clear he will not have the help of Putin in the election. Okay. The most important point in the debate.
Let me go back to London here. Adam, what's really interesting is that I suppose Hillary Clinton is very happy that she wasn't asked the following question. We know from these email links that that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were supporting, in every sense, ISIS in Syria. But you knew this, Madam Secretary, but you didn't do anything about it. As a matter of fact, you've denied it all along that there was any connection there. But no one asked that question. That was the most important question that could have been asked during that debate. If ISIS and fighting terrorism is so very important as her campaign claims. Go ahead, Adam.
Well, her campaign's clearly lying. Terrorism isn't important to her except when she can make money from it, and she's enriched herself quite a lot, as you quite rightly imply. If one wants to talk about puppets, I think that the puppet masters of Hillary Clinton and in Doha in Qatar are far more dangerous than the non-puppet and non-issue of Trump's totally non-existent relationship with President Putin and with Russia. All this information is on WikiLeaks. All of this information has been out for quite a while, and more comes out every day. Just this morning I read that in release number 15 of these Podesta emails, Hillary Clinton's advisors said she ought to emphasize the, God, I hate this word, bromance between Putin and Trump, who of course I can't emphasize this enough, have never met each other. And so you've got, again, a mainstream media. It is totally duplicitous. It is, as James said, McCarthyistic, but there's a very big difference between today and the 1950s. Joe McCarthy didn't have a Facebook page, nor did the people that he was excoriating and hounding and making miserable. And so the existence of social media, the existence of outlets like this and others, it makes the story very different, because people can call up the neo-McCarthy that is Hillary Clinton and her campaign. They can call her out on these lies and these fabrications, and they can also call her out on when she hides the truth about whom her own very wealthy, very dangerous, and very terroristic puppet masters are.
The abdication of responsibility from the media, because all our viewers probably know of and should know is the Pentagon Papers. It was a seminal event in American foreign policy history. We actually understood how the government worked when it came to the war in Indochina. Now we're beginning to understand how the State Department worked in dealing with the Middle East. And I will have to say that I thought Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton don't know the politics of the Middle East very well. They certainly don't understand the war in Syria. And these are the two candidates we have. And then even media didn't reflect upon the level of knowledge that both candidates have when it comes to a very serious issue. And you have to remember also, Russia has nuclear weapons. It's not Iraq, it's not Afghanistan, it's not Libya.
You're absolutely right, but let me get you the best quote from this John Podesta correspondence with Mr. Budovsky. Slaughter Donald for Putin bromance. That is the kind of language that they use. And if you look deeper into this article, for example, in the Time magazine, the article says that none of our sources provided evidence that would stand in court. So why are you writing this? Why are you making this cover if your evidence cannot stand in court? You admit it yourself in fine print. A few lines down.
She's
in your story.
She's from her husband.
And it's not only in the American media. I'm sorry, we have a clone of the Wall Street Journal here in Russia. It's called Vedomosti. So they don't say Russians are coming. They say Russian hackers are coming. And whom did Fancy Bear and Cozy Bear hack? They hacked Academy, formerly known as Blackwater, which is described by Vedomosti as a totally peaceful American organization specializing in information protection. So they forgot to mention that Blackwater killed a few hundred people, at least a few hundred people.
I'm not suggesting viewers read the Russian newspaper Vedomosti. But you know, James, what's really interesting is that it gets down to, in my mind, these are not hacks. These are leaks. And somebody in the Democratic Party is leaking these okay? This is what's really happening. And no one in the political establishment wants to admit this, that it's coming from Washington, D.C. itself. And there could be many reasons for it. Disgruntled former intelligence activists that know that Hillary Clinton, with her loose server, put other people's lives at stake here. All right, I'm going to have to end on that, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on stories in the media. Stay with our team. Where all things are considered, I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some of the stories that have made a difference in the media. I talked about in the first part of the program different narratives were coming out and what's happening in Aleppo and in Syria in general. You know, who's a good terrorist and who is a bad terrorist? I mean, this again, how impoverished we've gotten when it comes to journalism. It doesn't even make any common sense, but we keep hearing it all the time. Go ahead.
You know, Norman Solomon went to the Washington Post and asked if they ever retracted their coverage of the Tonkin Gulf resolution. And he was told by an editor at the Washington Post that if we did that, we'd have to retract 10 years of coverage. So these are organs that have supported the Vietnam War, never apologized, supported the war in Iraq. And you said that the Americans don't understand, or that the candidates don't understand a lot about the Middle East. Well, how about the public? What they can understand is Russian bombing Aleppo is bad, and America bombing Mosul is good.
American bombs are better than...
Yes.
They're actually have virtue, right, Dima?
Well,
they have virtue.
I think Robert Perry just hit it on the nail, you know.
And his outlet is called ConsortiumNews.com.
In his article, exactly, on Consortium News, he wrote about good deaths in Mosul, bad deaths in Aleppo. Well, actually, the American media, I like the way he put it, look how differently the New York Times prepares its public for the storming of Mosul. In fact, the New York Times is preparing the public. They write how people in Mosul are forced by the Islamic State not to trim their beards, to wear Islamic clothes, how people are punished for minor transgressions against the Islamic code of behavior. But the same thing had been going on in Aleppo, in the part of the city which is occupied by the rebels.
Right.
The rebels are good, Islamists are bad. But these people in Aleppo, this is Al-Qaeda, the people with the same ideology
as ISIS. Well, it's interesting,
ISIS,
like, you know, in Mosul, you talk about these groups, you name them. Adam, if I'm going to London, but when we're told about rebels in Syria, you don't name them, what their affiliations are. You know, what they do is they change names, they rebrand, and sometimes they change uniforms, but they're all supplied by the same sources, all by Washington and its proxies in the region.
Absolutely. If it weren't so tragic, one would be tempted to say there's the People's Front of Al-Qaeda and there's the Al-Qaeda People's Front. Most of these people don't even know themselves which black, red, bloodstained flag they're going to hold the next day. And turning, though, to this weird dichotomy, this parallel universe in which the media is portraying the Battle of Eastern Aleppo to free that from radical jihadist terrorists vis-a-vis that in Mosul in northern Iraq, I think there's something a bit more devious going on. We talk about humanitarian corridors in Aleppo, which were just recently bombed by those moderate rebels, you know, the ones who sterilize the knife before they use it to chop someone's head off. But when we're talking about corridors and safe passage in Iraq, there's a big fear of mine, and it was even inferred to by the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, that there's a concerted effort to take out some of the big ISIS leaders and whisk them across the border into eastern Syria to make things more difficult for the Syrian Arab Army and their allies to free the eastern part of the country from ISIS and their fellow namesakes.
Okay, you know,
well, Mr. Olan said he didn't want that to happen, but somehow he didn't have any critical words for the storming of Mosul. He saved all of his vitriol for Aleppo about war crimes.
And no real commentary, and he actually praises and hosts the White Helmets at the same time, which is its absolute disgrace.
A terrorist organization.
Oh, and even in public now, they say that they name their sources of funding, but still call themselves an NGO. And again, James, Western publics are not explaining this, though you can watch this on HBO.
The Western public It's very dangerous, you know. It doesn't matter what many publics think, but it matters quite a lot what the American public thinks, because we're getting cheerleaded into multi-trillion-dollar wars.
It's important to know what they don't know.
By Hillary Clinton.
Because you know, this is one of the remarkable things that I've seen. It's ever since the Iraq War is that you take foreign policy out of the mix. It's only the elites that can determine what foreign policy is. And you know what? The American public is sick and tired of these wars. But you do the rhetorical turn. Something must be done. And that's the trick. You prepare these audiences and publics for conflict.
I'm glad that James brought up this Tonkin incident. I mean, what happened in Yemen? A U.S. warship was supposedly targeted by Houthi rebels.
And then they don't know if it was targeted.
They responded by cruise missiles. And the problem is that if Daniel Ellsberg published his Pentagon Papers today, how would the mainstream media react? They would write that he stole, you know, these documents.
He's a traitor.
And he did it for Russia. I'm sure that would have happened.
For Russia for Russia's sake. And he would be judged for stealing. You know, they keep saying that this is like their property. They commit war crimes. There are papers.
Republican officials doing the people's work, and we have every right to know what they are doing. There's no difference there whatsoever. Just like Daniel Ellsberg did that. He did a tremendous service to the public to help end that terrible war.
From the modern point of view, Daniel Ellsberg stole these papers, because this is the kind of language that they use. You know, WikiLeaks, by publishing the correspondence of Podesta, where he is actually campaigning against Bernie Sanders, WikiLeaks stole these papers. Assange is a thief. You know?
Somebody leaked it to him. All right, I want to change gears here. Adam, we've used the word stolen. It looks like RT's voice in the UK, someone wants to steal that away. Can you elaborate? You know what I'm talking about. Go ahead.
It certainly does. Well, the headline should have run, state-owned financial cartel, the Royal Bank of Scotland, and its subdivision, the National Bank of Westminster, cut off the funds for an independent opposition television station. That, in a universe based on logic, that's what the headline would have been. Of course, the media establishment in Britain tried to whitewash it. They brought up the same stories about what RT isn't, completely ignoring what it is. But to be quite serious, it represents a new low for Britain. Britain's one of those awkward countries where the most patriotic song of England, Jerusalem, is actually an oppositional piece. It's a work of dissent. It talks about the lovely landscapes, these virginal rolling hills, being built over by, quote, dark satanic mills, in the words of the great poet William Blake. So a country where dissent is ironically part of tradition, this Conservative Party have wiped it away, but there is, luckily, in the spirit of Monty Python that we referenced earlier, something distinctly Britishly humorous about it. You've got Boris Johnson, a man whose great plan for Brexit was to rechristen a royal yacht. That didn't really go well. So it seems he's got his deck chair on the censorship, which is the only ship the British establishment seemed to be riding. But the people, just to show you how we aren't living in a McCarthyistic age yet, much though some would want us to, they've spoken out. They've spoken out online. They've contacted RT directly, and all this is going to do, it's really an own goal for the English establishment, it's going to get people to question more, which is what RT's mission is anyway. So I think that this failed publicity stunt is going to backfire.
Go ahead, jump in, Dima.
The Guardian doesn't agree with you. The Guardian is quoting someone named David Clark.
Can you name the author, please?
Yeah, David Clark, former Foreign Office advisor, who wrote the foreword for The Guardian. The clue is the strapline. Question more. They are trying to sow confusion and to create a climate of intellectual pessimism. Well, if you want a climate of intellectual optimism, you watch NATO TV or Pentagon TV, or even better, you watch North Korea TV. No confusion at all.
They're very inspirational.
Optimism,
yes, they are.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Or you can go to Pravda of Stalin's times, or you can go to the Third Reich, cinema, chronicles, you know. They have no confusion and no intellectual pessimism. If you have free press, if you have dissenting voices, you are going to have confusion, because you are going to have different opinions.
Well, that's the whole purpose of it here. James, the interesting thing is here, in defense of RT, is that I would like to know, in the entire panel and our audience, if our audience knows anyone that has ever been forced to watch RT. I would like to know about that, okay? Because I wonder under what circumstances can you force someone to watch a television station, okay? Because as far as I know, and Adam will confirm, there are a number of stations in the UK, so there is a choice out there. The most important question is why do people watch RT? Go ahead.
But there's diminishing choices above the line, you know, and there's a lot below the line if you hunt for it. But the average viewer who's worried about putting bread and butter on the table, they're looking at the mainstream media, and the mainstream media now has to toe the line. And, you know, Peter, I'd like to say more about this, but I'm afraid they'll shut my bank account. No, I'm kidding. But in 1971, there was a CBS documentary called The Selling of the Pentagon, where they took the Pentagon down for all its propaganda. I watched that with my father. I was 19 years old. My dad was a veteran of Iwo Jima.
Yeah.
He could watch that. He could be concerned. He had an opinion about it. It was on American mainstream media. My son is 19 years old right now. I can't sit with him and watch any type of critical program about the American military on the mainstream media. This is sad. We're joking, but I'm sad about that.
It's a strange situation, but I remember listening with my father to Radio Free Europe and BBC in the early 80s for precisely the same reason why people are turning to RT UK right now. You want alternative news because you understand that your own media is not reporting the full truth. You want to know the full truth.
Let me go to Adam here before we lose a run out of time. Adam, I mean, you look at the other stations in the UK. How much different is RT from the competition? 30 seconds.
It's considerably different because it's considerably better. It shows both sides as opposed to one side, and it approaches it, frankly, from a far more intellectual point of view, a much more engaging point of view, and a much more democratic point of view. But I suppose fighting for democracy is only okay if it's in the ports of Aleppo, controlled by the moderate rebels. And so it all really comes down to hypocrisy, hypocrisy, hypocrisy.
Okay, gentlemen, that's why I call us bullhorns. Thank you, Mr. John Kerry. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow and in London, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.